Hello, I'm Hugh Thomas, Deputy Editor at the Lancet Gastroenterology and Hepatology, and I'm delighted to welcome you to another episode of the In Conversation With podcast. The feature paper today covers a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial to explore the effect of expectancy and actual gluten intake on symptoms in people with non-celiac gluten sensitivity. If that sounds like a bit of a mouthful, don't worry, we've got a lot more on that paper, delving into the details very shortly. This article appeared in our February 2024 issue, and alongside this trial, other research reported in this issue includes maintenance data from the GALAXY 1 trial of guselkumab for Crohn's disease and an RCT of Botox injections for urge fecal incontinence. The review section includes an excellent overview of both intrahepatic and extrahepatic cancer risk in NAFLD, also known now as MASLD, and an authoritative synopsis of managing cirrhosis in low-resource settings. For all of this content, our correspondence, comment, and our usual news and in focus features, head online now to lancet.com. Without further ado, let's meet our guest for this episode. I am really honoured to be joined by Professor Louise Dye, senior author on the discussion paper and a chartered health psychologist and co-director of the Institute for Sustainable Food at the University of Sheffield. Her research focuses on the effects of nutrition on cognitive function, health and well-being, and in how to encourage and sustain dietary behaviour change at individual, organisational and societal levels. Professor Dye, thank you very much for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Hugh. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. So we always start off by kind of setting the scene a little bit. And I just thought I'd ask you, setting the scene, what is non-celiac gluten sensitivity and how does it differ from celiac disease and wheat allergy and some somewhat related conditions?
Wheat is one of our really common staple foods, and the consumption of wheat is generally associated with quite a lot of positive health effects, things like reduction of cardiovascular disease, diabetes and cancer. But there are some wheat products that may also have negative health effects, so wheat allergy and celiac disease. Celiac disease is a genetic disorder. It affects around 1% of the population of the Western population, let's say. And that's an autoimmune disease where people react to gluten. Wheat allergy is also an allergic reaction. So those are both celiac disease with 1% of the population having a reaction to wheat, and wheat allergy are diseases, if you like, conditions where we can see a real biological mechanism for that. Non-celiac gluten sensitivity, however, is where people perceive symptoms from gluten consumption, but they don't have celiac disease or wheat allergy. That's been ruled out by diagnostic tests. That it's probably important to say as well that although that's the definition that we would use clinically, many people self-diagnose and they're not actually tested for celiac disease. In the study that we did, we ensured that no one who participated actually had celiac disease, and that involved giving them a diagnostic test. So if they hadn't already had a diagnosis, a blood sample was taken and that was tested clinically to make sure that they didn't have celiac disease.
And so then what do we know about the causes of non-celiac gluten sensitivity? You mentioned briefly the kind of some underlying factors related to celiac disease and wheat allergy, but what about non-celiac gluten sensitivity?
We don't really know anything about the cause. We don't know what the exact trigger of the symptoms are that people report, or how this differs between different wheat species that they might be consuming. So it seems that in recent years, the number of people with non-celiac gluten sensitivity or non-celiac wheat sensitivity seems to have increased. It varies. The estimates are really variable between 0.5% of the population and 13% of the population who report symptoms after consuming wheat or wheat-containing foods like bread. And these symptoms tend to be mainly gastrointestinal. There are some extra-intestinal symptoms, things like fatigue and headache and concentration that people report, but we don't know the exact trigger.
Previous trials on this have suggested the existence of nocebo effects, the reverse of the placebo effect, where you have this exacerbation of symptoms with the belief that people are ingesting gluten. Can you talk briefly about those findings and what gaps were remaining after those studies have been conducted and how our understanding of these expectancy effects has evolved?
One of the key studies that was done by Jessica Bezierski, which was published in Gastroenterology about 10 years ago, was a double-blind crossover trial. What they did was they gave people a two-week gluten-free diet and then randomly assigned participants to high gluten, low gluten, or a control diet for a week and had a washout period of 2 weeks in between. And they didn't find an effect of gluten in those people who had this self-reported non-celiac gluten sensitivity. But what they did find was an order effect. So whatever they had first triggered the biggest reaction. And that kind of suggests that there's some psychological factors, let's say, or expectancy effects at play. But it wasn't really a nocebo trial. And that's what prompted us then to explore whether we could do a nocebo trial to explore this. So that would mean manipulating both the expectancy of what you're consuming and what you actually consume.
And I think that's, you know, a fascinating point about this trial, right? And I mean, it must have created some really interesting and unique challenges in the design phase. How did you go about with your co-investigators getting this trial off the ground, and what were the kind of the major issues you had to think about and overcome?
So one of the big issues, of course, is ethics, because someone might say that we're actually deceiving people. You know, the design does involve some deception. I'd rather say that we couldn't be completely honest with the participants, because that would have revealed the purpose of the study. So we had to think very carefully with our medical ethics about how to explain to people what the study was going to involve. Obviously, we had ruled out wheat allergy and celiac disease, and that was a condition to start the study. We had to tell people then that there was a 50% chance that they would get gluten and that that would be decided randomly. And we also had to make sure that the researchers didn't know who they were giving the gluten-containing bread to. So we had to be double-blind in both situations, because in many, many studies, when you're interacting with participants, you might give inadvertently cues that tell them, oh, the researcher thinks I'm going to react. I'm going to get gluten. I must be getting gluten. And that would, of course, also have an impact on the findings that we had. We wanted to see what people would generate in terms of their own reactions and not to influence that. So the researchers were also blinded, so there'd be no subtle exposure or communication about the actual treatment. And the participants were told there's a 50% chance you will get gluten. We couldn't do a crossover because then they may have noticed, or they would have said, oh, well, if I had gluten this week, I must be not getting it next week. So what we ended up doing was a parallel group study, but the groups were very similar in terms of their characteristics. I think the other thing that we had to do as well was, normally we would register clinical trials on clinicaltrials.gov, and we had to get a late registration approved to retain the confidentiality about the trial, so that the potential participants wouldn't find out what our intentions were until they were debriefed after taking part. It also made recruitment challenging, because there were some participants, you advertise a study where you ask, you know, are you sensitive to gluten? Do you avoid gluten? That kind of thing. And people come forward who fit that criteria. But then when you tell them that you want them to eat gluten during the study, people who have a very strong reaction are less willing to eat gluten. And actually, we found that some potential participants were unwilling to eat gluten, especially, and those tended to be people who said they had very strong effects. They wouldn't even try to gluten in order to be tested, because in order for an anti-TTG test to be sensitive, the person has to be consuming gluten. So some people said, oh no, I can't possibly do that. Yeah, I'm so sensitive, I won't do it. And those people that obviously we lost then to our study, and that could introduce some selection bias into the study that we have. So our sample arguably have less severe symptoms than the general population of non-celiac gluten sensitive people out there, but the results do show that clear effect of expectancy. We also excluded people who revealed other sensitivities, so if they had other allergies and so on, so that they weren't contaminating, if you like, that expectancy effect that we were looking at.
And just to summarize then, just before we get to the bit that everyone's waiting for and the results, what did the final study design look like in terms of, you know, how were the patients delivered the intervention? What groups did you have? And then those outcome assessments, what the things you were looking for?
So on the actual test day, so people had been screened. They didn't have celiac disease. They were eligible to take part. They were willing to take part. We actually had over 80 people who participated in the study. It was done in Maastricht in the Netherlands and in Leeds in the UK. And the participants were randomized into four groups. So they were informed that they were, half of them would receive gluten-containing bread and the other half would receive gluten-free bread. And that it was chance that would decide which bread they would get. And then on the test day, before they got two slices of bread for breakfast, they were told chance had decided that they were going to receive the gluten-containing bread. They were then given bread that may or may not have contained gluten, and asked to eat that bread. So they expected to receive gluten. And then at lunchtime, they were given two further slices of the same bread. So we had a dose in the morning and then a bolus dose at lunchtime, both of which they expected to be gluten containing. The other 50% of the subjects were told that they were going to receive gluten-free bread. So they didn't expect to receive gluten. And again, they had the same bread for breakfast as at lunchtime, only unbeknownst to the participant and unbeknownst to the researcher who was serving the bread, 50% of those people who were told that they were expecting gluten did not receive gluten. 50% did receive gluten. And the same for the people who were told that they were not getting the gluten bread. So that meant we had four groups of participants got gluten and expected to get gluten, got gluten and didn't expect to get gluten, didn't get gluten but expected that it was gluten, and didn't get gluten and were told that, and didn't get gluten and didn't expect gluten. So if you think about it, we've got every possible combination there. Having consumed that bread, then they stayed in the lab and we asked them to fill in visual analog scales, rating how they felt, rating both their intestinal symptoms and some extra intestinal symptoms. We also measured some things at screening like anxiety and depression and positive and negative affect scales, so that we could take that sort of, if you like, psychological characteristics into account in our analysis. So we use those as covariates. And actually, we didn't find that any of those characteristics were positively associated with the symptom reports. So that's quite nice, because that tells us that it's a lot more to do with our manipulation than the anxiety state of the participant. Clearly, if you think you are gluten sensitive and you're told that you're going to get gluten or you may get gluten, you might have an elevated anxiety level. But actually, that was the same for every participant in every condition, because they were all tested in the lab under the same conditions by the same researchers. So hopefully those kind of things didn't introduce too much noise into the sample.
Fantastic. And so moving on to the results then, and we're going to start right at the beginning. You mentioned obviously there were just over 80 people enrolled in this study. There were 83 participants, I think. What were the broad characteristics?
They mirrored very much the kind of characteristics that we see in the population that report non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So the majority of them were female. That fits with the demographic characteristics. We had half the participants from the Netherlands and half from the UK, but there were no differences between the countries, which meant we could merge those samples. They were probably people who are more aware of their diet. More of the females had IBS, so about 70%. But they weren't, and they weren't extreme on any of the psychological measures. We checked whether IBS actually affected the symptom levels, and it wasn't the case, and they didn't have extreme IBS. Those characteristics, both IBS and the proportion of males and females, was balanced across the four groups that I just described.
Moving on then to the symptom outcomes in each of those groups. What happened? What did you see?
The study showed that the expectancy to receive gluten-containing bread potentiated symptom occurrence. So people that expected to receive gluten-containing bread and actually did get the gluten had the highest symptom scores. People that expected to receive the gluten-free bread had the lowest symptom scores. And then the others fitted in between. So expectancy, the presence of the expectancy effect was really quite strong. So the highest symptoms, if you had the expectancy and you were exposed, you had the highest symptom scores. There was no difference in between the gluten-containing bread consumption and the no-gluten bread consumption if you were told you were not getting gluten. So if you were in the negative expectancy condition. So we can't rule out the effect of gluten or a biological effect of gluten. But there's no one explanation here. The presence of the expectancy magnified the effect.
I mean, I think that's perhaps one notable aspect to me. And I want to be quite cautious about how I phrase this. But, you know, there's that kind of suggestion, perhaps, that because you have this interaction between expecting gluten and actually receiving gluten, that perhaps there might be still some kind of remnant biological effect, or at least in some people. Or how do you interpret that data? I mean, obviously, there's room for this to be, you know, a quirk of the numbers, a chance quirk or biological effect. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think there really clearly is an effect of gluten. So the exposure effect is there, but it's really exacerbated by the expectancy effect. And it's interesting that in that negative expectancy, there's no difference between consuming gluten or not consuming gluten. So it's that combination of exposure and expectancy that produce the highest symptoms. That doesn't rule out a biological effect at all. If gluten had a biological effect, we would have expected stronger symptoms in the negative exposure expectancy group, which we didn't see. And there's also lots of variation between people. So there's also been muted that it may not just be gluten, but there may be other things, gliadin and other things that affect the intestinal barrier and that kind of sensitize people. The activity of the gut microbiota may be involved. There's a lot we need to learn in order to unpack what is really going on here. And I think what is the most important factor in how people to respond to gluten isn't that clear at the moment.
And so what do you think then these findings mean for how you and other clinicians might approach non-celiac gluten sensitivity in the clinic?
I think it's really important that we take people's reports of their experiences seriously in a clinical situation. I'm not a clinician, I'm a psychologist, but that is a real experience for those individuals. It's about finding the kind of interventions that work for them. So some people experience less symptoms if bread is made from spelt. Others report differences between sourdough and yeast fermented breads, the amount of fructans in the grain, all of those things could have an impact. So people will need to try different kinds of breads, different kinds of foods in order to see what works. Because what's really clear is that no one person reacts to every kind of bread. There's a lot of heterogeneity between patients, but everybody is having an experience which matters a lot to them and disrupts their everyday life. My Dutch colleagues are just about to publish a new paper where they've looked at 6 different types of bread and looked at how people react to those. And they found that only one person reacted to every single type of bread, and most could tolerate one or two of the three breads that they gave people. And they gave them emmer, which is an ancient grain, wheat bread or spelt bread. So there's a huge heterogeneity here that really deserves unpacking. And as people think more and more about what they're eating and how it makes them respond, it's about finding what works for them. Obviously, gastrointestinal symptoms can be distressing, and the extra intestinal symptoms that go along with them can also affect people's quality of life. So, but what we're trying to tease out here is the difference between exposure and expectancy. I think some of the media coverage can overhype some of those things and add to that expectancy effect. So I think what we also need is for social media in particular to be much more balanced in what they present to people.
We can only hope. We can only hope. I think, you know, I mean, this is perhaps one of these, I really enjoy the paper. I think it's absolutely fascinating. And I think perhaps one of the, my favorite aspects about it is just how many questions come out of this research. You know, it's like all great research, you know, it answers some questions, but it also prompts a lot more. So what do you think, what do you see as the kind of the further research that you're going to be interested in coming out of this study?
Yeah, I mean, I think the implications really are that we need to do future studies. We need to investigate how gluten can lead to symptoms in some individuals, but not others. And for whom it's most, who are the people who are most sensitive to expectancy effects? It may be that there is a gut-brain communication angle here, and we know that increased sensitivity of the gut might predispose people to more gluten sensitivity. But it's also important to see that people who follow a gluten-free or a gluten-restricted diet may also consume less or no other grains. And so we don't know whether it's the gluten or the components of the grain. So we've got some basic science to do here to tease that apart. And we also don't want people to avoid foods that are good for them because they are restricting too much. So we need to try and see this in the context of encouraging people to have a balanced diet as well, so we don't miss out on other nutrients because we're avoiding certain other foods.
You can read the paper on the non-celiac gluten sensitivity trial online now, along with all of the other content from our February 2024 issue at lancet.com. Thank you to Professor Louise Dye, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Lancet Gastroenterology and Hepatology podcast, In Conversation With. Remember, you can subscribe to In Conversation With wherever you usually get your podcasts.